Fearless Voyager Radio. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Yeah, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes of Timeless Voyager, speaking with Dr. David Orm Johnson from Maharishi International University. Dr. Johnson, you are in charge of keeping track of some of the most recent information that flows to and from the university concerning the different effects that are supposedly created there.
That's correct. Well, there's considerable evidence that people interact at a distance. I think this is something that happens all the time. It's something that we refer to as collective consciousness. If you go to a city, you feel its particular collective consciousness, like San Francisco is different from New York, which is different from Tokyo. And in our view, that collective consciousness is generated by the individuals in that society, and it's not just seeing them or experiencing each other through the senses, which sociologists, you know, talk about almost exclusively, but that there's a field effect of consciousness by which we influence each other. And if the collective consciousness is stressed, you know, due to the individuals and the society being stressed, then the probability of conflictual behavior coming out of that collective consciousness is increased. We're more likely to commit a crime of some sort in an environment where crimes are being committed or where there's a lot of stress. So our concept is that society can be improved by dealing with it on the fundamental level of its collective consciousness by increasing the coherence in even a relatively few members of society. It can have an effect on the entire society. And specifically, it's been found that the practice of transcendental meditation and the more advanced TM City program has a coherent influence on the larger society as measured by things such as reduced crime rate, reduced traffic fatalities, reduced hospital admissions. And there have been over 40 studies now demonstrating this effect, and many of them have now been published in refereed journals, such as the Journal of Conflict Resolution, Social Indicators Research Journal.
Now, what does a referee journal mean?
A referee journal means that experts in the methodology that was used in that study have looked over the research paper very carefully and have judged that it's of high quality and meets the standards of the field, and therefore can enter into the published body of literature in that field. It becomes part of the public domain. But it means basically that experts have looked over your work, and it's not that they've said that they're true, that they think it's true or they believe it, but it means that you've done the research in a way in which, you know, that there aren't methodological flaws. It has to be taken seriously and looked at.
So are these statistically significant studies?
Oh, yes.
And for our listeners, why don't you just explain what it means for something to be statistically significant?
Well, it means that it doesn't happen by chance. What if, for example, you wanted, this is a real example of an experiment that was done, you wanted to demonstrate that a coherence-creating group of people, meditators, could influence the war in Lebanon. So you'd have to have a measure of that, and the way you do that is you take descriptions of the war on a day-by-day basis as reported in the various news media, news services, and those can be coded according to who does what to whom when, and those descriptions can be coded according to the degree of conflict or the degree of cooperation. If it's an all-out land war, then that gets a high mark for conflict. If it's some verbal hostility, then it's some lower number. You can actually code them numerically. And so you have a description of the fighting, for example, in Lebanon on a day-by-day basis with a numerical value of how conflictual it is or how much cooperation there is. Now, say that within the stream of events that are going on, you want to demonstrate that you can create an influence of peace. And so what we did actually is, in one study, is we created a coherence-creating group of practitioners of TM in Jerusalem, and we predicted when it got to a certain size, which we can discuss what that size would be, and it was over 250 people, when it got to a certain size, that the conflict in Lebanon would be effective. And to be statistically significant means that the change that takes place when you have your coherence-creating group, in this example, is not something that you could expect by the kinds of fluctuations that you see in the data. You know, it'll have some ups and downs in conflict or towards peace on a day-by-day basis. And to be statistically significant, at, say, at the 0.01 level, means that there's one chance in 100 that you would have seen that much peace during that particular period just by chance, given the kind of fluctuations that, usually occur in the data.
Now, these are the types of studies that are have been published and authenticated. Is that the right word, authenticated?
And replicated. This study that I described just briefly now, we found that over a 70% reduction in war deaths, which is a very objective variable, number of people killed in Lebanon during the time that we had large numbers of TM City participants in Jerusalem. And there were also changes in Israel as a whole. We measured several quality of life indices, such as crime rate and traffic accidents, number of fires, national mood. And on all of these different indices, quality of life improved in Israel and the war decreased in Lebanon. And that study was published in the Journal of Conflict Resolution.
Now, you've replicated this then?
Yes. A study following this looked at seven different occasions in which there were groups of meditators predicted to influence the war in Lebanon. In one case, it was a small group within Lebanon itself near the conflict zone, a group of about 100 or so. In another case, it was a group on the other side of the world, here in MIU in Fairfield, Iowa, of 7,000 to 8,000 people. The idea is that the larger the group, the coherence-creating group, the larger the population it will influence.
All right. Now Maharishi, I understand, has proposed a solution then to the Gulf crisis, which is a group of about 7,000 meditators to create the coherence that's necessary to change the Gulf crisis situation. Is that right?
That's correct. 7,000 is the square root of 1% of the world population, which is a number that's predicted to influence the entire world. And since the Gulf crisis is really a worldwide crisis, it involves everybody, what's needed to handle that crisis is a group that creates coherence in the entire world.
Now this I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but this Maharishi effect that you're speaking of, again, we're talking about a formula which has been replicated over and over again, and you have arrived at the square root of 1% of a particular population.
That's right.
And you've decided that 7,000 is 1% of the square, the square root of 1% of the population of the world?
That's correct.
All right. Okay.
And in previous research, on three different occasions, we had groups of 7,000 in 83 and in 84 and in 85, and for about a week to 3 weeks and different times. And we found that worldwide international conflicts decreased very significantly during those periods, and international terrorism decreased over 70% during those three periods. So this and the 40 other studies on the Maharishi effect means this influence of coherence in society, have shown that this really works, and we want to try it out in the Gulf crisis right now. And what we're proposing is to create a group of 7,000 anywhere in the world to create coherence in the world. And what we predict would happen would be that there would be a peaceful resolution of the conflict without going to war.
Now let's stop with that for a moment, and let's come back to this then.
Okay.
How is it that people meditating in one place then affect other people at a distance? Now I know you started to talk about that in the beginning of the conversation,
right?
But why don't we just nail that down right now?
Okay. I think that in order to understand how people can influence each other at a distance, we have to take recourse to our understanding of the structure of nature. And from modern physics, and the idea is that we are all interconnected on the level of basic quantum fields, that the objects that we see around us are made up of different quantum fields, electromagnetic field and gravitational field and the strong and the weak interaction, and that these are universal fields which no doubt interconnect us. So we are interconnected with each other and with the stars, with everything, for example, on the level of the gravitational field or electromagnetic field. So the question then for social scientists is, if we are interconnected on a physical level, does this have any relevance to our behavior? And we, as I mentioned earlier, we experience on a subjective level that we do feel a kind of collective consciousness when we go into a home or something. But our explanation of it is, in terms of modern science, that the deepest structure of nature is the level of the unified field, which brings together all of these different quantum fields. And physics has glimpsed this unified field. It has various theories of it. And what we're saying is that during these meditation procedures, we're operating on the level of this most basic unified field, which interconnects everything. And this is what creates coherence in society. This unified field is what creates, it's what underlies all the order seen throughout the universe. So we find that nature is orderly on every level, from the atomic level to the galactic level. And when the human mind identifies with that unified structure of nature, human behavior also becomes more orderly, and the influence of those individuals is one of creating order around them. And by order in society, we mean that it's evolutionary, it's life-supporting for the individual and for other people, so that instead of conflicting, they cooperate.
Now, people don't have to believe this, do they?
No, they don't have to believe it at all. We think that that collective consciousness is something that that's there all the time, that we're influencing each other all the time, and all we're saying is that let's add this technology to make our influence on each other more coherent. But I think many people are not aware that there are many famous scientists who've had the insight into the unified structure of nature. And not only that it's a unified structure, but that it's a field of consciousness. And this is a very ancient idea, which modern science, I think, is now coming around to. The idea that it's not, that the unified field of natural law is not something that's far removed from us, but it's actually our own consciousness at its deepest, most basic level. And for example, Sir James Jeans, who was a British physicist and contemporary of Einstein, said that 30 years ago we thought or assumed that we were heading towards an ultimate reality of a mechanical kind. Into this wholly mechanical world, life had stumbled by accident. Today there is a wide measure of agreement, which on the physical side of science approaches almost unanimously, that the stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. Mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We are beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter. Not, of course, our individual minds, but the mind in which the atoms of which our minds have grown exist. And the ancient knowledge of the Veda from India, which Maharishi is reviving, has the idea that this basic unified level of nature, this cosmic intelligence, is the basic level of our own mind. That our thinking mind and its ordinary activity is excitations upon this ocean of consciousness, and so we experience our mind as sort of a localized excitation ordinarily, but when we meditate, we allow those excitations to quiet down, and we experience that ocean of consciousness which underlies all of nature, not only our own mind, but all of nature, and we become connected with everything else at that level. And when that happens, it creates an influence of coherence in the entire society, and that will solve the Gulf crisis.
How do we know that the influences will always be positive?
because it's from that level of natural law, which is all purely evolutionary. And I know this is a new idea of nature. Usually scientists, I think, tend to think of nature as being value neutral. It's neither positive nor negative from a moral point of view. But from our point of view, the deepest level of natural law is a level of pure intelligence, which is purely pro-life. That is, it's purely evolutionary. When an individual experiences that and becomes more self-actualized, then that individual is an expression of this positivity of nature, which means that the things that the person does and thinks are supportive to that person's evolution and growth, and also supportive of everyone else's evolution and growth. In this view, the deepest level of natural law, the unified field, which is this level of nature's intelligence, is one's own self. And from this perspective, good and evil can be defined in terms of the degree of connectedness with one's own self. That which is good is that which connects one more and more to one and other people, to one, because it's the same self in both cases, with oneself or other people. Good is that which connects an individual more and more with one's own self, and evil is that which takes one more and more to the excited levels of mind and away from the direct experience of one's own self.
All right, so we've talked about the coherence that you're creating.
Right.
I think a very important question to be asked at this point is, would any meditation techniques have the same effect if they produce transcending?
Well, if they produce transcending, they would. Transcending means that the mind is taken progressively back to quieter levels of mind to transcend its own activity.
Now, is there evidence to show that your technique, transcendental meditation, isn't actually different from other techniques that purport to do the same thing?
As far as the what happens during the meditation process, there are physiological studies which show that TM is uniquely different, for example, from just sitting with your eyes closed, or from autogenic training or progressive relaxation. And there are studies which look at what happens physiologically when someone experiences transcending to this state of pure consciousness, the inner self. What happens is that the breath slows down and the brain waves become very, very coherent. As far as the effects of TM, there was a recent meta-analysis which is a quantitative way of reviewing a large number of studies, and it looked at 149 different experimental outcomes on the effects of trait anxiety, comparing transcendental meditation with all other kinds of meditation and relaxation techniques.
Now, I want to interrupt for one second.
Yes.
What was the name of this now? It was what kind of a...
It's called a meta-analysis.
All right.
It was by Kenneth Epley and published in the Journal of Clinical Psychology a few months ago.
Okay.
And what it did is it compared TM with other meditation and relaxation techniques, and it found that TM, looking at all the studies that have ever been done in the last 20 years, which was about 149 outcomes, one published paper may have more than one outcome. And what it found was that TM produced twice the relaxation, twice the reduction of anxiety as any of the other techniques, which were not significantly different from each other. So there is experimental evidence that TM does something unique, and we feel that what it does is it's a very efficient way to take the mind to transcendental consciousness, this unified field level within each person, and it's from that this effect on collective consciousness arises.
All right,
is not to say that other techniques don't also maybe occasionally allow one to transcend, and there are even individuals who have the experience of a subtler unified level of their own mind spontaneously. And I'm sure that these people have a very powerful, coherent effect on the environment.
All right, now, where do all these people get together, and they're all practicing transcendental meditation and the TM City program, which perhaps some of my listeners may not be familiar with. Do other people practice also there, or just the people who are in this particular group?
In the studies that we've done, it's always been groups practicing transcendental meditation in the TM City program. Maybe I should define those briefly. Transcendental meditation is a meditation technique taught by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, which allows the mind to go from active level to inner quietness to the unified level. And the TMC program allows the mind to operate on that silent level, so it kind of stirs that unified level of consciousness, of natural law. And it's practiced, and it's most powerful when it's practiced in groups, it's been found.
Now, you mean the group is actually all in the same place?
That's right. For example, here at our university, Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa, all of the students and faculty meditate twice a day in two buildings that we built for that purpose. They're golden domes. And that's how we begin and end our day.
Now, this is a pretty big dome, then, or these are big domes.
Yes, there's about 2,000 people, so it's about 1,000 people in each one. And what we found is that, for example, this group has been meditating together since 1979, that the larger, in different times, there are more or less people, depending on whether the students go home for vacation and different, you know, sometimes we have special courses, and as many as 7,000 people have been here at one time. And we find that the fluctuations in the dome predict fluctuations in the quality of life in the United States. When the numbers are higher, there's fewer suicides, fewer auto fatalities, fewer homicides. There's an improvement and a reduction in unemployment. And when the numbers are lower, then those things go back up. So there have been many studies have shown that the group practicing together has a very powerful influence on the collective consciousness.
Do you have any information on effects that may have been produced during that time?
Well, we had a group from October 14th to 21st. We wanted to create a group to have an influence on the Gulf crisis, and about 1,000 people came here in addition to the usual group that's here. So we had about 3,000 people meditating here.
Now, that wasn't the right number, is that correct?
That wasn't 7,000, which is for the whole world. But even so, we found that there was a softening of the Gulf crisis, which could be seen in various reports in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and other newspapers.
Now, was this statistically significant?
We're just about to study it statistically.
Okay.
But what we found was is the business community perceived that there was less likelihood of war, and the stock market went up 100 points, and the price of jet fuel and crude oil came down very dramatically that week. And then when the 1,000 people went home again, because they had to go back to their jobs and so forth, everything reverted back. The stock market went back down, and oil prices went back up. And
well, now let's take the stock market, for example. Do people who follow those trends on a regular basis, are they aware, and do they gear up whenever they hear that there's going to be a course?
There are some investors who follow our numbers very closely, but the stock market's a complicated variable. What we predict is when there's more coherence in society due to these meditating groups, that things are going to be more evolutionary. And the stock market increasing may sometimes be evolutionary and may sometimes not be.
Oh, I see.
So, for example, coming out of an economic recession, an increasing stock market is usually considered to be a positive thing. It means that there's optimism in the business community, and it's used by the government as a leading economic indicator of the end of the recession. However, once you're out of a recession, then it may be that the stock market going up means that prices are inflated and overvalued, and it may not be a good thing. It may be better that it adjusts and come back down a little bit.
All right, let's come back and actually nail this down for a moment. Now, we have the idea that a certain number of people can affect a larger number.
That's right.
That's that principle of coherence. Is that principle of coherence in nature, are there other biological examples of that?
Yes, I think that we see it all the time. For example, in the heart, there are a few pacemaker cells which lead and kind of synchronize the beating of the entire heart. In the brain, when you measure the EEG, it's about 1% of the cells working together in a synchronous way that gives rise to the EEG that you actually measure. And in general, there's a principle that coherence is more powerful than incoherence. That in a laser, for example, if you have a relatively few of the atoms working together in a coherent way, means their light waves are the same frequency and they're lined up with each other, then you begin to get a laser beam out of it, whereas the incoherent elements have a much weaker effect. So the principle is that the coherent elements have an influence which is proportional to their number squared. So if we're working together on something, our influence is multiplied, and if we're not, then our influence is just additive. And so because of that, you can have the square root of a population working together coherently will have an influence which will influence the entire group. The square root times some constant, which in this case is 1%, where the 1% comes from. It's an empirically defined constant.
Now, we have an example then from biology. We have examples from physics.
Yeah.
And is the problem then that the sociological examples are not, there aren't enough of them, or is it that the community is not looking at this seriously? What is the situation then?
Well, I think it's a new idea, especially the idea of action at a distance, that we're influencing each other at a distance. Certainly the fathers of sociology talked about such things. People like Emil Durkheim had the concept of a collective consciousness, and Carl Jung talks about the collective unconsciousness and or unconscious. And William James talks about us being interconnected, and so does Gustav Fechner, the father of psychophysics, had an experience of the interconnectedness of people. But it's not a general part of experimental psychology because people weren't able to do anything with the theory. No one had any way to manipulate this so-called collective consciousness in order to have a measurable influence. So I think that's what's new now, is we have a very powerful technique for influencing this construct we call collective consciousness and measuring it so that its effects can be measured and can be studied.
Now, let me ask you this then. Our government spends an extraordinary amount of money, or is spending an extraordinary amount of money, to be over in the Gulf right now.
Right.
What solution are you presenting? And let's talk dollars. I mean, are we talking about saving money and influencing a change in the crisis at the same time?
Well, what we propose is that the government or private individuals or anyone maintain a group of 7,000 as a profession.
Now, these have to be 7,000 people who practice this particular technique. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right.
That's right. And they could be anywhere in the world.
But they have to be in the same place.
They have to be in the same place. So, for example, if you had them in a poor country like Cambodia, for example, for probably about $3 or $4 million, you could maintain a group like that every year.
Oh, I see. So, in other words, if you take this particular consciousness affecting group and put them in a country where the costs of housing are low enough, you can then, in a sense, have the same effect, but it doesn't cost as much money.
That's right. They could be anywhere in the world. It could be a retirement village. It could be a school. And if the political leadership and the wealthy of the world, you know, don't respond to this idea, then it could even be 7,000 youth who would like to enjoy enlightenment and higher states of consciousness at the same time, spontaneously free the world from fear and the tyranny of war.
What is the problem here then? I mean, my goodness, this is not that expensive. It seems to me that we have spent a tremendous amount of money on sillier
That's right.
Sillier things here in this country, investigating all kinds of strange things. Why can't we seem to raise this money and try this out or start it or do something with it?
Well, I think it's such a paradigm shift for people. The idea, first of all, that people influence each other at a distance, that, you know, that one can sit and go within to this field of silence within them, and that's going to create coherence in the entire environment. Even though such things have been talked about in every culture, you know, in various traditions. In the Vedic culture of India, for example, Patanjali talks about that in the vicinity of yoga, which means a person who's in union with this unified field level within themselves, that animosity is quelled, that fighting just won't occur. And in Taoism, there are several references to such an effect, such an influence. It says that when the king or the ruler goes to that silence within himself, then his people spontaneously behave themselves. And in the Bible, there's the idea, there's a story of Abraham went to God, and God said, find me 100 righteous people, men or women, and I'll spare Saddam or Sodom. And then Abraham came back and said, well, what about 10?
I see.
Said, even for 10, I'll, you know, righteous people, I'll spare the city. And then he came back and said, well, what about one, you know, Lot? And God said, well, you better tell Lot and his wife to leave town quickly,
right,
and don't look back. So again, you have this traditional understanding almost in every culture that, you know, people who become more integrated within themselves will have an integrating effect on the entire nature, and that negativity will disappear. But it's not something that's lively in our culture right now. It seems that people sort of approach it as a completely new idea. And even you know, getting it published took a long time. They had to go through a lot more steps than it usually does in journals to satisfy all the referees and reanalyze the data in a million different ways. And even when it's published now, people still, you know, people, I think that it's not part of our culture, and they don't experience it every day, but I think they do experience it every day. It's just a matter of becoming aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johnson, you were about to embark on an explanation of the seventh state of consciousness.
That's right.
All right, let's hear what that's going to be.
Okay, well, seventh state of consciousness is normal human life. It's called unity consciousness. And we started out by
saying, you use the word normal,
meaning that our development should take us to that, but because we've lacked the technology, the educational technology, most of our, almost all of us in the world, our development has been frozen at much earlier levels, and we're immature. We're a whole race of immature human beings.
All right, so let's hear about this state then.
Well, we said at the beginning that the view of nature is that it has a unified structure, that there's a unified field underlying nature, and that could be directly experienced as our own self, that the intelligence of nature is the self. So when we begin this timeless voyage towards unity consciousness, we experience transcendental consciousness, pure consciousness, unbounded awareness within ourselves. That's the fourth state. When we get to unity consciousness, which is the seventh state, we begin to perceive the outer world also as that same unbounded, unified field value. Even though we still perceive, you know, differences and so forth, what we know to be the reality, what we experience to be the reality, is that it's all one big ocean of consciousness. The inner self, I am that, thou art that, all this is that. It's a level of Vedanta in Vedic psychology or in Vedic philosophy.
All right, that was pretty good. That kind of sums it up.
Okay.
Tell me about your understanding of this new technology of consciousness now as the ultimate technology.
Well, I think that all technologies are really technologies of consciousness. We think of electronics in terms of computers and different devices, but actually the technology is the knowledge of how to use silicon and how to do various things, knowledge of electronics. So it's really a technology of consciousness. You know, technology of aircraft are not the aircraft flying around. They're the thoughts about how to make aircraft.
So you're saying that we already have been exercising a technology of consciousness in that we've been making things out of thoughts and bringing them to fruition.
That's right. And that every technology from picking up a stick and using it as a tool to developing wheels to computers and to all the modern technologies are technologies of consciousness, but that this technology of transcendental meditation and the TM City program is the ultimate technology of consciousness because it takes consciousness to its unified basis, which is the basis of all thoughts, all actions, all conceptions. And when we unify our mind on that level, then our understanding and our, you know, creativity and everything becomes the understanding and creativity of nature. We become much more in tune with nature. Any technology is only as good as its attunement with natural law. You know, if we understand electronics, we understand how nature works within the realm of the electromagnetic field, for example. But if we can attune our mind directly to this unified field level of natural law, which is our own self, then that's the ultimate technology, because then we become integrated with the deepest level of nature. Our life becomes purely evolutionary. And the byproduct is that our society becomes very ideal, even to the level of creating heaven on earth, which is what we predict is going to happen in the 90s.
Heaven and earth meaning?
Meaning that all good everywhere and non-good found nowhere.
So what we have to do is get out of this situation in the Gulf crisis, and so you are asking for...
group of 7,000 meditating together is the first step, just to create enough coherence and world consciousness that doesn't go to a conflict.
And this needs to be done pretty fast, or we're going to be in trouble.
It needs to be done fast, that's right.
Now,
there's various efforts around the world to create such groups. We're trying to create a group in Armenia and in Israel and here at MIU and in various places in the Soviet Union.
Well, it seems to me from what I hear in the newspaper or hear in the television, reading the newspapers, that we've spending all of our time now on this buildup because I guess that seems to be the direction we're going in. And you're saying that this is not necessary at all if we were just to spend our time on putting this group of people together who would supposedly, according to the documentation that's been presented, be able to alleviate the crisis in a small amount of time with no problems at all, no conflicts at all.
Yeah, what we find is that the same people who have all kinds of reasons for fighting with each other, when the coherence rises in these experiments we've done in the past, they start finding reasons to cooperate with each other. It's like it's just a change, like night and day. And we don't propose that, you know, that we. People don't do all the military things they're doing because they have various reasons they have to do it. But we know from history that's not going to work, and in fact it's going to lead to disaster. And there's absolutely no scientific research which underlies any of the policies that are being tried right now, whereas this approach has a lot of scientific documentation showing that we should at least try it before we commit young Americans to a major land war.
So the most important thing that you've said so far is that while everyone keeps asking for documentation on showing that what you're saying you can do will cause a change, on the other side of it, no one ever looks through history to find out that no conflict has ever changed anything.
That's right.
All right.
And a buildup of arms has always led to war.
Right.
Historically, so.
My guest today has been Dr. David Orm Johnson. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to participate in the interview.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, Bruce.
And my goodness, I would look forward to learning more about your statistics that you begin to finalize now. And please keep me informed of what's going on also. And I would love very much to have you back on the show in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.